You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll hear about an effort to bring yoga into schools to reduce stress for teachers and their students.
First, President-elect Donald Trump won the electoral vote earlier this month. Those votes will be cast in mid-December. But yesterday afternoon, the president-elect falsely stated that widespread voter fraud cost him the popular vote. While campaigning for president, Trump had talked about a rigged system. Yesterday's tweets marked the first time he alleged voter fraud in his own victory.
Trump's comments followed earlier criticisms of Green Party candidate Jill Stein and the election recount, which he called a, quote, scam. He doubled down on Clinton's concession after Election Day and said that the recount would not change anything.
David Cannon joins us now. He's professor of political science at UW-Madison. He studies elections. David, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
Let's start with this claim, something on the order of 3 million illegal votes cast, counting Donald Trump tweeted for his loss in the popular vote, not in the electoral vote, obviously. How would we evaluate a claim like that?
Well, there's no credible evidence for voter fraud anywhere on that kind of scale. That it's just like there's no evidence to back that up at all. The one type of voter fraud that we know like just does not exist at all is voter impersonation fraud. There have been systematic studies of this that have shown that it's on the order of, you know, single digits of voters out of millions of votes cast of people who actually do try to impersonate, you know, someone at the polls and vote under someone else's name. Now, there are two other kinds of voter fraud that do happen with some more regularity, and it's just, you know, very hard to know exactly how common these are. And it would be non-citizens voting and then people who are convicted felons voting in states that don't allow felons to vote. And in most cases, it's just a question of, you know, ignorance of the law, just not being aware of the fact that, you know, you live in a state where a felon can't vote, or in some cases, you know, non-citizens not knowing that they're not allowed to vote. But I've never seen any credible estimate that anywhere close to 3 million cases of that in a given election. It's on the order, you know, more like thousands rather than millions.
And what do you make of the situation where the president-elect of the United States is casting that kind of doubt on the integrity of the vote, saying that 3 million or so votes were cast in one way or another illegally?
Well, it just really doesn't make any sense for him to do this. And it's the kind of thing where his you know, statements that are so out of bounds from what we, you know to be factually true really serve to undermine the confidence in the electoral system for no good reason. And I think he'd be much better served to say, let's let the recounts go forward, and I'm sure that I'll be vindicated in my victory after we have the recounts, and let's, you know, let that proceed. And he would be right on that score, actually, that it's extremely unlikely that the recounts will overturn anything like the, you know, 20,000 plus votes in Wisconsin, or 10,000 plus votes in Michigan, or 70,000 and change in Pennsylvania. That in fact, there was a study done by Fair Vote, is a nonpartisan group that looks at elections, and they counted that between 2000 and 2015, there were a little over 4,600 statewide general elections. 27 had recounts, and of those, only 3 actually overturned the results. And we're talking about like hundreds of votes that changed, not 20,000. And so the largest tally, in fact, that was changed in any recount since the year 2000 was in Florida with Al Gore, who trimmed about 1,200 votes off of George W. Bush's lead. But again, that's nowhere close to the 20,000 plus that we'd need in Wisconsin to change the outcome.
Talking to political scientist David Cannon from UW-Madison about claims from Donald Trump saying something on the order of 3 million votes illegally cast, which cost him, he says, the popular vote, not any documentation or evidence of that. David, people have been talking about Donald Trump casting doubt on the election system. Is there a case to be made that the recount itself, the questions being raised in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania might do something similar, cast unnecessary doubt on the outcome of elections?
Well, Well, I mean, I think what Jill Stein is trying to accomplish, if you take her at face value, is that she is in fact trying to do the opposite, which is to restore confidence in the system by showing that in fact we can count the ballots and look at the ballots and then have more confidence in the result by doing a recount. So I think her intention here is to try to make people more trusting of the outcome by actually having a hand recount.
Do we have, can we look at our elections in the United States and say, by the standards of elections around the world, we have pretty good election integrity? We can generally count on the results of our elections being fair and accurate?
We actually do have a very robust election system here. In fact, just about a week before the election, I met with two election observers who were from Europe, and they have spent the last 10-15 years going around the world looking at elections and electoral processes for the EU. And this is the first time they've been in the United States observing elections, and they were both quite impressed, actually, with what they identified as the robustness of our elections. And one thing that helps us a lot is that, in terms of election integrity, is that we're such a decentralized system that, in Wisconsin, we have nearly 2,000 election officials that are processing election results. And so to think about widespread fraud, actually stealing an election, you would need to influence so many people, in Wisconsin especially, but even in most states, it's at the county level. So you have, dozens and dozens of election officials who are overseeing the process. And so that means that because we have such a decentralized system, it is very difficult to imagine a conspiracy big enough to try to steal an election on that scale.
I've seen concerns raised that talk like, there were 3 million illegal votes cast could lead states, maybe even the federal government, to enact new election laws that might be unnecessary. Is that a concern that you have?
Well, yeah, I think that is a concern. And the whole question of voter ID in the first place, which was based on this idea of voter fraud, of voter impersonation fraud, has been shown to just not be true, that we simply don't have that kind of voter fraud. And so if this kind of claim was then used to have even more restrictive voting laws, I think that would be a real harm to democracy in terms of limiting participation. And we already have in this country participation rates for voting in national elections that is way towards the low end of, comparing us to other Western democracies. So we don't want to be in the business of trying to deny people their right to vote. And instead, I think we should be doing things to try to encourage voter participation.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay, good to be with you.
That's David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about claims from President-elect Donald Trump about widespread voter fraud and not presented with evidence. The claims came after both Jill Stein and Hillary Clinton's campaign backed an election recount in Wisconsin and other states.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our school is expecting too much from parents. We'll talk to the author of a report that says schedule conflicts between working parents and their kids' schools may be taking a greater toll than many people realize.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
People do yoga for many reasons. For Ellery Lowry, yoga provided the grounding she needed in a new town.
Breathe in. Close your eyes. Set an intention for your practice. Keep this intention in mind as you flow through your poses. If you find yourself struggling, if you find yourself hurting, if you find yourself unable to focus, come back to this. Come back to your intention. Breathe out. I've spent a lot of time in my life trying to clear my mind. Since my freshman year of college, I've struggled with mental illness. I have depression and anxiety. Both of these lead to my mind being frequently clouded with worry and negativity. When seeking help, I learned how to combat these thoughts. In therapy, you're taught not to worry so much about things that are out of your control. I found myself often being bogged down by worries about my future, about money, about if people liked me. With the help of my counselor, I was able to better combat these thoughts. She taught me to let go of things I can't control. I learned to remind myself that I can't answer many of my concerns right now, and it's not worth worrying over. Don't think so much about those other people who might be applying for the same jobs as you, my therapist would tell me. I also learned to believe people and have faith in them. Your friends aren't lying to you. They wouldn't spend time with you or support you if they didn't care about you. If my mind started to cloud, I was able to focus and clear my head with these skills. Practicing mindfulness is part of any meaningful yoga experience. The discipline encourages being in the moment. Focus on where you are, listen to your body, and breathe. While doing yoga, you clear your mind and concentrate on grounding yourself and exercising your body. If you find yourself letting thoughts slip back in, you return to your mantra. You breathe in, you breathe out. When I first looked into yoga, I was interested in it as a physical exercise. I'd had friends who'd enjoyed yoga for its spiritual and mental benefits. "I appreciate my body more for its function than its size now," said one. "I feel so good and much more relaxed after practicing," mentioned another. "I didn't go to yoga class hoping for any of these benefits. I just wanted a fun exercise and to hopefully meet people in Eau Claire after recently moving from Iowa. Before my first class, I was nervous. I was unsure if I'd like a class environment or if I'd be able to connect with anyone. After my first yoga class, I felt lighter. I was so relaxed. My mind was calm. I went home feeling refreshed and loose. I felt stable. My worries and doubts and concerns had been let go for the night. I now find myself looking forward to my class every week. I'm always happy to see my instructor and my fellow classmates. I'm ready to continue my journey of balancing and strengthening my body and my mind. And I find myself setting intentions for myself in my daily life. I take a moment to clear my mind when things are overwhelming. I am more gracious and kind to myself. If I've hit a bump and I'm faced with difficulty, I don't panic. I stop and clear my mind. I breathe in, I breathe out.
Ellery Lowry is an independent radio producer. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
A nonprofit group in Madison is bringing yoga into classrooms to help teachers and students deal with stress.
Here to tell us more about that program is Alana Nankin, founder and CEO of Breathe for Change. Alana, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me here.
So how did the Breathe for Change program get started?
So in 2009, I started teaching pre-K in a Spanish dual immersion school, and as a first-year teacher, found myself, like many teachers, very stressed, overworked, and overwhelmed. And that's when I found practices such as yoga and mindfulness and started integrating them into my life and found incredible benefits for my own well-being. And then also started using these practices with my young students and saw just absolute transformations in my classroom and in their ability to learn. And then in 2012, I came to the University of Wisconsin to pursue my PhD in curriculum and instruction. And for the last 3 years, have been a teacher educator in the teacher education program. So I've had the amazing opportunity to teach courses to pre-service teachers who are then going to go into the classroom and change kids' lives. And last year, my students found out that I was a yoga instructor and thought it was pretty cool and asked if they could rent out space in the student union for me to teach them yoga, meditation, mindfulness practices. And I started doing that, and without me even telling them to bring it to schools, they naturally started implementing these practices with kids all over the Madison schools and kept coming back to me saying, "Ilana, it's working." These, you know, kids who had a lot of trouble either focusing or were experiencing trauma are really improving their emotional outcomes. And they said, "Train us." And at the same time, I was following eight teachers who I had taught for 2 years in the teacher ed program into their their first year of teaching, and created a community to support them. And it was so clear that within even the first few months of their teaching, they too, just like I was, became so stressed, so overwhelmed, and yet didn't necessarily have the tools to take care of themselves so that they can then, of course, take care of our kids. And so seeing the ripple effect of these practices really positively affecting kids and these teachers all over, and then seeing at the same time, teachers just so stressed and not have the tools to take care of themselves, I was like, okay, I need to do something about this. And then I started Breathe for Change.
So it sounds like it's addressing the needs of teachers, but it also has a component for students so that they can take part of these same practices. So how do you go about implementing that? I mean, teachers have so much on their plates right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the reason for the stress.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of requirements. They have to get a lot of instruction time in the classroom. How do you make time for yet one more thing, even if it's a positive thing?
Well, so the way that we have structured our programming for teachers is we do a 200-hour wellness and yoga teacher training for educators. It's the only one in the world that's ever been designed specifically for teachers. And that takes place over the summer in a very intensive 16-day training. And so, you know, teachers have time off, so that works. And so we train teachers to basically become experts of these practices. And then we also have a school-wide wellness program that supports these teacher leaders, or we call them our school wellness champions, in implementing these practices not only into their own classrooms, but supporting them in creating the space to teach the other teachers at the school, as well as their students and their entire school communities.
We're talking with Alana Nankin right now. She's telling us about how yoga and mindfulness can benefit Wisconsin's classrooms, the teachers and the students, and she's the founder and CEO of Breathe for Change. And you've been mentioning the practices. Can you walk us through what some of them might be for teachers in the classroom?
Absolutely. So it's obvious that teachers already are like at their final capacity in terms of, you know, the curriculum that they have to implement. And so this is not in place of math or in place of literacy by any means. It's to support what they're already doing. So, for example, we teach teachers little techniques that they can use in transition to transition kids from one subject to the next, something like a little breathing technique or something to focus them in. We also have a bunch of techniques that teachers can use in community circles to build classroom community and the culture, and to really improve and deepen relationships between students and also teachers and families and whatnot. We have a lot of times, especially with students who are experiencing trauma or have really challenging lives, they have higher levels of stress and anxiety, which negatively affect their academic outcomes, of course. And so what we believe is that if we utilize these techniques to minimize the stress and the anxiety that they're feeling, and to give them the tools to be able to regulate their emotions on their own, then the academic outcomes are going to be so much better. And so we teach teachers those techniques, from little meditations to mindfulness activities to community building exercises that they can implement in any way across the school day, whenever it feels like the right moment that their kids need that.
And one of the things that seems unique is that this is specifically geared to a teacher's mm-hmm. life and the things that happen within a classroom. I mean, I've heard of mindfulness exercises being brought in and the kids participating, but what seems unique is that they're being integrated as part of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you see it?
Absolutely. So, I mean, for example, let's say a teacher has to teach young children the concept of prediction, you know? So they're reading a story, and they ask children, how do you make, or what do you predict is going to happen next? And in our case, we would think, wait, well, maybe if you took them through a visualization in this literacy activity, and you taught them, or you had kids close their eyes and think about what's happened in the story so far and visualize that, and then visualize what do you think is going to happen next, and then have them, you know, see that and open their eyes, and then it engages such a deeper learning experience where they're still teaching and getting across the same concepts, but they're using these wellness and techniques that research shows has incredible benefits to students' learning and their overall well-being to help them get to the learning outcomes that they're already trying to do.
Is this a hard sell in schools? I know you brought this to Madison. Mm-hmm. You're still expanding in Wisconsin in general, and you also have some roots in the Bay Area, so you're doing things there. Are people ready to add this on and to bring this to schools and to kids, or is this something that you have to convince them on?
So it has been mind-boggling how it's not even just easy. It's the principals and the teachers and superintendents want this. They're coming to us. They're seeking it out. After the training, we hadn't even created the school-wide wellness program yet, but it was because teachers and then principals were coming to our team saying, we want this in our schools. How do we do it? That we created this wellness program. And what we did was we met with principals of the teachers that went through our program and found every single conversation that we had was, it seemed like a yes. And the question is how can we do it? And the principals have all been and the school leadership and all of the teachers at the school have been just so positive and so excited about what they're seeing. And we've been doing 2-hour professional developments that start with transformation of self. Then the second one moves into transformation of teaching, which is really about the integration of the practices into the classroom. And then transformation of school community, which is really about sharing these techniques with the entire school community, including the families. And we've just seen that teachers are coming to us and saying things like, I've never felt this calm in 25 years of school, or this has absolutely transformed my teaching. So it's very exciting.
Alana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Alana Nankin, founder and CEO of Breathe for Change program to bring yoga into schools and help reduce stress for students and teachers.
Coming up, our guest says working parents have a hard time participating in school events, conferences, and more because work and school schedules just don't always match up. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Reveal. Tonight, Reveal looks at public assistance programs in the United States and the prospects for welfare reform in a Republican-led federal government. That's coming up tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, for many parents, the constant shuffle between work schedules and their children's school schedule can create a logistical juggling act and ongoing stress for everyone involved. We'd like to hear from you on this. Do you find it difficult to keep up with your child's school schedule? Are you frustrated with school policies regarding picking up maybe a sick kid? Are you able to work in conferences, afternoon events into your schedule? I'd like to hear about your experience at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Our next guest published a report for the Center for American Progress that suggests this parental balancing act may be taking a greater toll than many people realize. Joining us now is Ulrich Boser. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Ulrich, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Ulrich, you're a parent, and I wonder if you might start us off with a story from your own life about why you say schools expect too much from parents.
Yep, I got a phone call from my school recently that asked me to come in to give my daughter some Tylenol. And, you know, I've had a number of these experiences over the years, you know, where our school is closed for professional development today. And with some colleagues at the center, we looked at schools across the country and found that policies like this are very common. In some areas, schools might close for the start of hunting season, or schools are regularly closed for parent-teacher conferences or these training days. And, you know, we just wanted to make a point and show that, you know, these policies have a negative impact on working families. And, you know, we found, you know, a huge impact on the economy of $55 billion because parents aren't able to you know, mix, you know, work with school life.
Now, schools, of course, will need to be closed for various reasons, as you said, things like holidays or breaks, that sort of thing. So do you have a sense of how many days a year schools tend to be closed?
Yeah, so when we compared working schedules for your typical worker versus school schedules, we found that school districts are closed about a month, 29 weekdays on average. And that's really more than most working parents have in paid vacations and holidays. And that doesn't include summer vacation. And what I want to be clear here is that, you know, we're not asking schools to now suddenly, you know, take on the task of childcare. But we do think that with a little bit more thoughtfulness, we can create schedules that work better for parents as well as for schools.
And what might that thoughtful schedule look like, do you think?
Sure. We were in touch with one school in New York City where they had the teachers working from 9 to 5, but only then working 4 days a week. And so that allowed a schedule that worked better for the parents in that community. It allowed more flexibility for the teachers as well. You know, for teachers who they have summers off, but it's very hard for them and during the week to take time off to visit the doctor or go shopping. And so that day off during the typical work week allowed them a little bit more flexibility. And it didn't cost that school a lot more money to roll out this program. But we think that, you know, these types of innovative situations or policies and programs could work in a lot of areas.
And it sounds like you also found that there is an economic cost in lost productivity that comes along with some of these scheduling issues you're describing. What's the case for that?
When you think about these days off, like professional development days, parents, and I'm sure many of your listeners know the feeling of, you know, running around trying to figure out, you know, what am I going to do with my child on this Friday, as it often happens. And so that causes, you know, parents either take time off from work or be less productive or have to pay out of pocket for babysitters or childcare. And so we calculated that up and tried to put a number on, given an estimate what this costs for parents.
And do you have a sense about whether it's something that's universally perceived as a problem, or are there certain groups that maybe struggle more with this in the parents?
What we found, you know, in speaking to parents and speaking to other experts is that disadvantaged families, families that might be working, you know, service jobs, whether they're working in restaurants and hotels, and they don't have a lot of notice about what times they have off, will struggle with this a lot more. One, their schedules are less flexible. Two, they have less disposable income to move around to, you know, cover these sudden days off.
We're talking right now with Ulrich Boser, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, talking about a report that he co-authored on the misalignment of schedules between parents' work schedule and their children's schools. And you touched on this a little bit earlier, Ulrich, about the end time of a lot of schools. It can be anywhere from early afternoon to mid-afternoon, and most jobs that are 40-hour-a-week jobs, or at least many of them, you know, you're going to be there until maybe 5 o'clock in the evening, sometimes later than that. So how does that end up stacking things?
Yeah, you know, when we looked around to figure out, you know, why do schools end at 3 o'clock or 3:30 or 2:30, depending on the area, there's not really any argument for it, right? I mean, it's something that's arisen over time. It's merely sort of an aspect of our culture. And so, you know, why is that? What can we do to do more to support teachers, to support students, to support working parents? And there are innovative ways to either integrate after-school care into school, or to, you know, do more to work with the rhythms of student life. And we all know the feeling of, you know, around 3 o'clock when you sort of get tired. You know, what can we do then to offer either more recess or more academics for whatever students need? And that, you know, 3 o'clock closing time is peculiar, and we wanted to sort of question why it exists and lay out some, you know, proposals and programs and ideas for schools and communities that are willing to take on this issue.
Well, I know here in Wisconsin, I mean, I'm looking out a window right now, and it's pretty much pitch black outside. So if kids are getting out of school now at 5 o'clock, they're going to be walking home in the dark, which isn't something parents of younger kids are going to be very happy about. So maybe there are some practical concerns there, like, for instance, daylight savings time.
Yeah, certainly there are practical concerns, and really what we wanted to highlight with our report is it should really be local communities to, you know, up to local communities to assess this type of issue, right? So in some communities where maybe you have a lot of parents working late nights, you'll want to offer more in those areas. So, you know, what we really, though, wanted to highlight was this issue of, you know, we have schools that close regularly for all sorts of holidays, much more than most working families have time off. Many schools start early. Some start as early as 7:30 in the morning. We know that that doesn't work well with teenagers' time schedules. So how can we, you know, move beyond that and see what's best for our communities and what's best really for working families?
And speaking of working families, there has been a call lately that the federal government take up things that support working families, maybe paid family leave, other social structures like that. Just briefly, are the concerns that you're levying here something that could maybe be better taken up by policymakers at the federal level than rather than putting the burden on individual schools themselves?
Yeah, what we laid out in our report is trying to document all the ways that a lot of federal money that goes out right now could be used for these types of services. This can quickly get into the details of school funding, which I think for our listeners we're going to avoid, but there are large pots of money currently available to schools and school districts across Wisconsin that can use this money for these types of programs. So certainly we would love to see federal lawmakers take up this issue when we look at, you know, issues like paid leave and how hard we fought around those. It doesn't necessarily seem like it's going to happen anytime soon, but when we look right now at the local level, there's a lot that schools and districts can do if they want to think more creatively about how they schedule their school days, how they think about engaging parents in school day to day, and you know, make systems that work better for all those involved.
Ulrich Boser is with us right now. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, talking about his new report, co-authored, the misalignment of schedules between parents and their children's schools and the impact that this could have on the modern working family.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have trouble juggling work and your children's school, the schedule, the sick time, the days off, making it to conferences and other events? Are there things going on in your school district that help you with that? If you work on the school side, what is your take on all this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're continuing our conversation now with Ulrich Boser, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, talking about why he says schools may be asking too much from parents and the impact this might have on the modern working family and the U.S. economy.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have trouble navigating your work time and your children's school time if you work at a school? How do you try to reach out to parents who might have to work during a conference time or other important events throughout the school day? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Jan joining us in La Crosse. Jan, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious to ask your guest. He said he wasn't sure why schools ended at 3 o'clock, and that seemed kind of arbitrary. But I am a teacher and a parent, and I know that our schools end at 2:45 to accommodate sports. And I was wondering if they looked at that at all. Our school used to start at 8:30 years ago, but then because of sports activities and parents complaining kids were getting home too late, they moved it back to 7:30, and so that the sports activities can take place and music. And, for example, I have a 17-year-old junior who right now is at basketball till 6 o'clock, and then from 7 to 8:30, he goes to jazz band.
Wow.
So he's at school from, and he left at 7 o'clock this morning. But if we didn't have school ending earlier at 2:45 or 3, then he wouldn't be getting home till 9:30, 10 o'clock at night.
Jan, thank you so much for raising that. That's right. Lots of extracurriculars. Jan's own son has basketball and jazz band, and there's things like that. So how do you fit all that in if you're getting having a school day that maybe is more aligned for some kids with a parent's maybe 9-to-5 schedule?
Yeah, well, this seems like a school that has put some clear thought into how to schedule the school day, and certainly extracurriculars, whether it's jazz band or basketball, are really important, especially for young adults who are growing, and we want to make sure we have, you know, well-rounded young adults. And, you know, I think overall what we can do is think more holistically about this and make sure that the programs are integrated, and so that, you know, if a student wants to then maybe take band earlier in the day, or we can think about ways in which a student who might need a little bit of extra help in math can also make sure to get these types of programs. You know, I can't speak specifically to this school system, but what we've seen in other school systems is that, you know, it's often piecemeal the way that these different programs are pulled together. And what we found in looking across the U.S. is that more can be done to really coordinate these types of programs to make sure that they're meeting the needs of parents and teachers.
Jan, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate that call. And we go next to Georgia joining us from Madison. Georgia, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
Well, I just, as I was starting to listen to this segment, what it occurred to me is that I think that maybe you're approaching the problem from the wrong end. In other words, you're saying that the problem is that schools aren't adapting to parents' work lives. And I guess that what I would say is, when I was growing up, very often there was one parent at home. You know, families didn't need to have two incomes in order to, you know, make a living. And that allowed for more flexibility to raise kids, which, honestly, I think that that's really what's missing, is that flexibility in our work lives to be able to raise children.
Georgia, thanks a lot for bringing that up. And what about that, Ulrich? I mean, should we be looking at workplaces being more accommodating and making it easier for parents to get to things instead of asking the school to do maybe more of the thinking and the contorting?
Yeah, I think that's really a great point. You know, on one side, I want to say, look, you know, we have to be careful about the realities of America today, and in many families, both parents are working, and a lot of the assumptions around school system today seem to have this sort of 1950s ideal of sort of, you know, Mad Men, where the man works and the woman stays at home, and that's clearly not the situation that we see in a lot of families today. We have women working and doing and you know, really participating in the workforce, and that's something that we really need to make sure that we continue to support. On the other side, you know, it's very clear that the middle class in the U.S. today is eroding, and you know, it is very hard, whether it's a man or a woman who's working and trying to raise a family on that single income. So, you know, I think we can work on both of these issues, making sure that schools are more flexible to the needs of working families, while at the same time recognizing that, you know, middle class incomes are stagnating. You can see this specifically with teachers. You know, if you have a teacher's salary, it's very hard for that to support two or three individuals. So what we can also do then to raise wages to make sure that families can support themselves on these incomes.
We've got a comment here from Wendy on Facebook who says, I do find it challenging to find balance as a mother of one school age and two non-school age children while working full time. However, I think the workplaces should be more flexible. Education is the cornerstone, she says, of a productive generation. That should warrant the flexibility parents need to accommodate the next generation's education. So one vote there for looking at the way workplaces conduct themselves and the impact that could have on families. And Ulrich, just briefly, is technology going to be part of this? Just about out of time, but what do you think?
Absolutely. We've seen a few schools use Skype for parent-teacher conferences, and that's, I think, one concrete way that a school can use technology to incorporate parents in a way that works for both.
Ulrich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Ulrich Boser with us, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and he was with us to talk about a new report that he co-authored looking at why schools may be asking too much from parents and what the cost could be to a productive society.
Dairy milk has long had a special place on the food pyramid. It's always been a kitchen staple, but now it's starting to share the refrigerator with alternatives like almond milk, soy milk, and rice milk. As WPR's Halima Shah reports, the increased competition has some in the dairy state worried.
The dairy aisle at the Willie Street Co-op in Madison is filled with familiar names like Sassy Cow and Organic Valley. But these traditional milk products are increasingly sharing the shelves with alternatives like almond milk and soy milk. According to grocery category manager Dean Callis, customers want options.
There's quite a number of people with dairy allergies. There's quite a number of people who are vegetarian or vegan and don't necessarily want to drink dairy.
In the last few years, dairy milk sales in the U.S. have been dropping. Jordan Rost is the vice president of consumer insights at the global marketing research firm Nielsen. And he says there's been a parallel rise in sales in the most popular kind of alternative milk, almond milk.
On the whole, almond milk has grown about 8% year on year. And that's in this contrast of the overall milk category contracting at about the same rate.
And while Rost says 8% is a drop in the bucket when compared to the overall milk market, it has been enough to frustrate farmers in the dairy state. Tina Hinchley is a dairy farmer in Deerfield and a member of the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. She says the dairy industry is struggling because prices are a lot lower now than they were a few years ago. So, for dairy farmers like her, the popularity of a competing drink is icing on top of an already financially challenging cake.
It's not only almond milk, it's the soy, it's the rice, it's all the different varieties of stuff. And, you know, now you have your juices as well in the dairy case. Anything that is different that kids can consume that's in competition with milk, it's hard on our industry.
She also doesn't see almond milk as real milk. And there are probably a lot of other farmers who would agree. A recent ad campaign funded by the dairy industry aimed to portray milk alternatives as, well, less than pure. In the ad, a girl at a spelling bee struggles to spell the word lecithin, an additive that's commonly found in nut milks. Her competitor is a boy who wins the spelling bee by spelling a much more familiar word.
Spelling bee.
Lecithin.
Lecithin. L-E-S.
Your word is milk.
M-I-L-K.
Milk wins.
Back at the co-op, there are shoppers who have their reasons for buying drinks like almond milk, like vegetarian Bailey Lyons and her spouse Rhea Lyons.
We chose the Almond Breeze almond milk. Yeah, we buy it because we like it better. It's better in cereal. It's better in baking. And it doesn't come with the guilt associated with buying cow's milk.
But for dairy farmers like Tina Hinchley, dairy milk is significant beyond its taste or its place in the latest wellness trend. She says it's also about the state's identity.
The heritage of the state of Wisconsin, even Minnesota, even Michigan, this is a dairy country here. And our legacy for this state and for our families is to continue dairying.
Nut milks may be having their moment in the sun right now, but it may not last. A growing number of people are now discovering split pea milk. Halima Shah, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.